Disc 4.
Chapter 13. The Hundred Days. Monsieur Noirtier was a true prophet, and things progressed rapidly as he had predicted. Everyone knows the history of the famous return from Elba, a return which, without example in the past, will probably remain without imitation in the future. Louis XVIII made but a faint attempt to parry this unexpected blow. The monarchy he had scarcely reconstructed tottered on its precarious foundation, and it needed but a sign of the emperor to hurl to the ground all this edifice composed of ancient prejudices and new ideas. Villefort therefore gained nothing save the king's gratitude, which was rather likely to injure him at the present time, and the cross of the Legion of Honour, which he had the prudence not to wear, although Monsieur de Blacas had duly forwarded the brevet. Napoleon would doubtless have deprived Villefort of his office had it not been for Noirtier, who was all-powerful at the court, and thus the Girondin of 93 and the senator of 1806 protected him who had so lately been his protector. All Villefort's influence barely enabled him to stifle the secret Dantès had so nearly divulged. The king's procureur alone was deprived of his office, being suspected of royalism. However, scarcely was the imperial power established, that is, scarcely had the emperor re-entered the Tuileries and issued his numerous orders from that little cabinet into which we have introduced our readers, and on the table of which he found Louis XVIII's snuff-box half full, than Marseille began to rekindle the flames of civil war, and it required but little to excite the populace to acts of far greater violence than the shouts and insults with which they assailed the royalists whenever they ventured abroad. Owing to this change, the worthy shipowner became at that moment, we will not say all-powerful, because Morel was a prudent and rather a timid man, so much so that many of the most zealous partisans of Bonaparte accused him of moderation, but sufficiently influential to make a demand in favour of Dantès. Villefort retained his place, but his marriage was put off until a more favourable opportunity. If the emperor remained on the throne, Gerard required a different alliance to aid his career. If Louis XVIII returned, the influence of Monsieur de Saint-Méran and himself became double, and the marriage must be still more suitable. The deputy procureur was therefore the first magistrate of Marseille, when one morning his door opened and Monsieur Morel was announced. Anyone else would have hastened to receive him, but Villefort was a man of ability, and he knew this would be a sign of weakness. He made Morel wait in the antechamber, although he had no one with him, for the simple reason that the king's procureur always makes everyone wait, and after a quarter of an hour passed in reading the papers, he ordered Monsieur Morel to be admitted. Morel expected Villefort would be dejected. He found him, as he had found him 6 weeks before, calm, firm, and full of that glacial politeness, that most insurmountable barrier which separates the well-bred and the vulgar man. He had penetrated into Villefort's cabinet, convinced the magistrate would tremble at the sight of him. On the contrary, he felt a cold shudder all over him when he beheld Villefort seated, his elbow on his desk and his head leaning on his cane. He stopped at the door. Villefort gazed at him, as if he had some difficulty in recognizing him. Then, after a brief interval, during which the honest shipowner turned his hat in his hands,
"Monsieur Morel, I believe," said Villefort.
"Yes, sir."
"Come nearer," said the magistrate, with a patronizing wave of the hand. "And tell me to what circumstance I owe the honour of this visit?"
"Do you not guess, monsieur?"
asked Morel. "Not in the least. But if I can serve you in any way, I shall be delighted."
"Everything depends on you."
"Explain yourself, pray."
"Monsieur,"
said Morel, recovering his assurance as he proceeded,
"do you recollect that a few days before the landing of His Majesty the Emperor, I came to intercede for a young man, the mate of my ship, who was accused of being concerned in a correspondence with the Isle of Elba, and what was the other day a crime is today a title to favour. You then served Louis XVIII, and you did not show any favour. It was your duty. Today you serve Napoleon, and you ought to protect him. It is equally your duty. I come, therefore, to ask what has become of him."
Villefort made a violent effort. "What is his name?" said he. "Tell me his name."
"Edmond Dantès."
Villefort would evidently rather have stood opposite the muzzle of a pistol at 25 paces than have heard this name pronounced, but he betrayed no emotion.
"Dantès," repeated he, "Edmond Dantès?
"Yes, monsieur."
Villefort opened a large register, then went to a table. From the table turned to his registers, and then, turning to Morel, "Are you quite sure you are not mistaken, monsieur?" said he, in the most natural tone in the world. Had Morel been a more quick-sighted man, or better versed in these matters, he would have been surprised at the king's procureur answering him on such a subject, instead of referring him to the governors of the prison or the prefect of the department. But Morel, disappointed in his expectations of exciting fear, saw only in its place condescension. Villefort had calculated rightly.
"No," said Morel, "I am not mistaken. I've known him 10 years, and the last 4 he has been in my service. Do not you recollect I came about 6 weeks ago to beseech your clemency, as I come today to beseech your justice? You received me very coldly. Oh, the royalists were very severe with the Bonapartists in those days."
"Monsieur," returned Villefort, "I was then a royalist, because I believed the Bourbons not only the heirs to the throne, but the chosen of the nation. The miraculous return of Napoleon has conquered me. The legitimate monarch is he who is loved by his people."
"That's right," cried Morel. "I like to hear you speak thus, and I augur well for Edmund from it."
"Wait a moment," said Villefort, turning over the leaves of a register. "I have it. A sailor who is about to marry a young Catalan girl. I recollect now it was a very serious charge."
"How so?"
"You know that when he left here he was taken to the Palais de Justice?"
"Well?"
"I made my report to the authorities at Paris, and a week after he was carried off."
"Carried off?"
said Morel.
"What can they have done with him?"
"Oh, he has been taken to Fenestrelle, to Pignerol, or to the Ile Sainte-Marguerite. Some fine morning he will return to assume the command of your vessel."
"Come when he will, it shall be kept for him. But how is it he has not already returned? It seems to me the first care of government should be to set at liberty those who have suffered for their adherence to it."
"Do not be too hasty, Monsieur Morel," replied Villefort. "The order of imprisonment came from high authority, and the order for his liberation must proceed from the same source, and as Napoleon has scarcely been reinstated a fortnight, the letters have not yet been forwarded."
"But," said Morel, "is there no way of expediting all these formalities of releasing him from his arrest?"
"There has been no arrest."
"How?"
"It is sometimes essential to government to cause a man's disappearance without leaving any traces, so that no written forms or documents may defeat their wishes."
"It might be so under the Bourbons, but at present—"
"It has always been the same, my dear Morel, since the reign of Louis XIV. The Emperor is more strict in prison discipline than even Louis himself, and the number of prisoners whose names are not on the register is incalculable." Had Morel even any suspicions, so much kindness would have dispelled them.
"Well, Monsieur de Villefort, how would you advise me to act?"
asked he. "Petition the minister."
"Oh, I know what that is. The minister receives 200 every day and does not read 3.
"That is true. But he will read a petition countersigned and presented by me."
"And will you undertake to deliver it?"
"With the greatest pleasure." Dantès was then guilty, and now he is innocent, and it is as much my duty to free him as it was to condemn him.
"But how shall I dress the minister?"
"Sit down there," said Villefort, giving up his place to Morel, "and write what I dictate."
"Will you be so good?"
"Certainly, but lose no time. We have lost too much already."
"That is true. Only think that perhaps this poor young man is pining in captivity."
Villefort shuddered at this picture, but he was too far gone to recede. Dantès must be crushed beneath the weight of Villefort's ambition. Villefort dictated a petition in which, from an excellent intention, no doubt, Dantès' services were exaggerated, and he was made out one of the most active agents of Napoleon's return. It was evident that at the sight of this document the minister would instantly release him. The petition finished, Villefort read it aloud. "That will do," said he. "Leave the rest to me."
"Will the petition go soon?"
"Today."
"Countersigned by you?"
"The best thing I can do will be to certify the truth of the contents of your petition."
And sitting down, Villefort wrote the certificate at the bottom.
"What more is to be done?"
"I will answer for everything."
This assurance charmed Morel, who took leave of Villefort and hastened to announce to old Dantès that he would soon see his son. As for Villefort, instead of sending to Paris, he carefully preserved the petition that so fearfully compromised Dantès, in the hopes of an event that seemed not unlikely.
that is, a second restoration. Dantès remained a prisoner, and heard not the noise of the fall of Louis XVIII's throne. Twice during the 100 days had Morel renewed his demand, and twice had Villefort soothed him with promises. At last there was Waterloo, and Morel came no more. He had done all that was in his power, and any fresh attempt would only compromise himself uselessly. Louis XVIII remounted the throne. Villefort demanded and obtained the situation of king's procureur at Toulouse, and a fortnight afterwards married Renée. Danglars comprehended the full extent of the wretched fate that overwhelmed Dantès, and, like all men of small abilities, he termed this a decree of providence. But when Napoleon returned to Paris, Danglars' heart failed him, and he feared at every instant to behold Dantès eager for vengeance. He therefore informed Monsieur Morel of his wish to quit the sea, and obtained a recommendation from him to a Spanish merchant, into whose service he entered at the end of March, that is, 10 or 12 days after Napoleon's return. He then left for Madrid, and was no more heard of. Fernand understood nothing except that Dantès was absent. What had become of him? He cared not to inquire. Only during the respite the absence of his rival afforded him, he reflected partly on the means of deceiving Mercedes as to the cause of his absence, partly on plans of emigration and abduction, as from time to time he sat sad and motionless on the summit of Cape Ferro, at the spot from whence Marseille and the Village des Catalans are visible, watching for the apparition of a young and handsome man, who was for him also the messenger of vengeance. Fernand's mind was made up. He would shoot Dantès, and then kill himself. But Fernand was mistaken. A man of his disposition never kills himself, for he constantly hopes. During this time the Empire made a last appeal, and every man in France capable of bearing arms rushed to obey the summons of their Emperor. Fernand departed with the rest, bearing with him the terrible thought that perhaps his rival was behind him and would marry Mercedes. Had Fernand really meant to kill himself, he would have done so when he parted from Mercedes. His devotion and the compassion he showed for her misfortunes produced the effect they always produce on noble minds. Mercedes had always had a sincere regard for Fernand, and this was now strengthened by gratitude. "My brother," said she, as she placed his knapsack on his shoulders, "be careful of yourself, for if you are killed I shall be alone in the world." These words infused a ray of hope into Fernand's heart. Should Dantès not return, Mercedes might one day be his. Mercedes remained alone upon this bare plain, which to her eyes never appeared so barren as now, with a mighty sea stretching to the horizon. Quite dissolved in tears, like Niobe, she wandered without ceasing about the little Catalan village, halting at one time under the fierce heat of the southern sun, standing upright, motionless and dumb as a statue, her gaze fixed on Marseille. At another, sitting on the shore, listening to the moaning of the sea, eternal as grief itself, and asking herself continually whether she would not be better to cast herself in, to let the deep open and engulf her, rather than to suffer thus all the cruelties of waiting without hope. It was not want of courage that prevented her putting this resolution into execution, but her religious feelings came to her aid and saved her. Caderousse was, like Fernand, enrolled in the army, but being married and 8 years older, he was merely sent to the frontier. Old Dantès, who was only sustained by hope, lost all hope at Napoleon's downfall. 5 months after he had been separated from his son, and almost at the very hour at which he was arrested, he breathed his last in Mercedes' arms. Monsieur Morel paid the expenses of his funeral and a few small debts the poor man had contracted. There was more than benevolence in this action, there was courage, for to assist even on his deathbed the father of so dangerous a Bonapartist as Dantès was stigmatized as a crime.